The Curbside Sedation Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Life Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
It's been a long time, Kat. How are you surviving in the heat wave in New York?
I'm really hot, Sean. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Yeah, I mean, equally hot, I guess, in Connecticut, but mostly surviving with my two kids by taking them outside to run out their energy in the heat.
Good for you for going outside. That's very brave.
Lots of sunscreen. Welcome back, everybody, to the Curbsiders Addiction Med, our mini-series on substance use and disorders. I am Sean Cohen, and I'm joined by Dr. Kat Mullins today. On tonight's episode, we get to discuss hallucinogen with Dr. Albert Garcia Romeo. But before we get started with all that, Kat, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
I will happily do that, Sean. We are the addiction medicine podcast that uses expert interviews to demystify common addiction medicine topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for all individuals who use substances. And a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. Listening to this episode and completing CME can be used to count toward the new DEA 8-hour requirement on substance use disorders education.
Woohoo! Get your CME. This podcast is also brought to you by the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, or ACAM, and they offer a variety of products that support your professional development and career journey. You can stay up to date with the latest addiction medicine with their professional practice bundle and ensure you're ready to pass the ABPM board exam with their board prep bundle. They have a ton of great resources. I used a ton before I took the boards. If you want to excel in academic addiction medicine through networking, fellowship opportunities, and other educational resources, visit ACAM at acaam.org.
So we have a really fantastic conversation with our guest tonight, Albert Garcia Romeo, PhD. So Al is an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. His research examines the effects of psychedelics in humans with a focus on psilocybin in the treatment of addiction. His current research interests include clinical applications of psychedelics, real-world drug use patterns, diversity in science, and the role of spirituality in mental health. He is a founding member of the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelics and Consciousness Research and an associate editor for the journal Psychedelic Medicine. Dr. Garcia Romeo teaches us many pearls here. So I think one piece is just going through what it actually looks like to have psychedelic-assisted therapy. What is the structure there? We don't get that from reading the studies. And then secondly, just how we can actually talk to our patients. What are the risks here? What are some of the potential benefits if this is really done in a structured therapeutic way? So without further ado, let's get to it.
And just to add, Dr. Garcia Romeo does have a couple of disclosures. He's served as a scientific advisor to a few companies, including Interwell and Otsuka Pharmaceuticals. He's also received research funding from Microdose Therapy, Inc., Mitocine Innovations Incorporated, Unlimited Sciences, the Council on Spiritual Practices, the Hefter Research Institute, the National Institutes of Health, and the Departments of Defense. And I apologize if I butcher anybody's names coming up, but he has funding through the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research provided by Tim Ferriss, Matt Mullenweg, Blake Mykowski, Craig Narenberg, and the Stephen and Alexandra Cohen Foundation. And if you couldn't tell from all his funding, he is a real fun guy. No,
but a bum.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. So without further ado, let's actually get to this episode. Okay, Al, this is our kind of lightning round where we want to ask you a couple rapid fire questions because we want to get to know you a little bit better. So can you give us a one line summary of you?
I am a psychologist who studies drugs and addiction. I've been working at Johns Hopkins for about 12 years studying psilocybin in particular.
Awesome. And how did you get into psilocybin research, the field of what drew you into that?
I was primarily interested in spiritual and transformative experiences that people sometimes have. These are not always elicited by psychedelic drugs or even by drugs at all. They're often occurring in the context of meditative or contemplative practice. They sometimes happen spontaneously. So that was really what my focus was in graduate school, when I was trying to understand altered states of consciousness and their relationship to mental health. In particular, what ways we could use altered states of consciousness as interventions to try to help people, for instance, to recover from addiction or mood disorders, other types of problems that they might be facing in a psychiatric front.
Great. Well, we could get into some topic related questions. So thank you so much, first of all, for joining us. So we're going to start with a patient case. So I will go ahead and read this to start. So Mr. Hoffman is a 32-year-old male with major depressive disorder, alcohol use disorder in remission for 3 years, and no other medical history, who presents to your office for a routine visit. He states that a number of his friends have been microdosing mushrooms and wants to hear your thoughts. So my first question, we really do not get a lot of this in medical school, I have to say. So what is he talking about?
Sure. I mean, we could spend a long time talking about that. And I'll start with a caveat, which is I'm not a clinician. I don't see patients. And so if a patient walked into my office, I'd tell them to go see a doctor, because I'm a psychologist and I'm not a psychotherapist either. So I'm really, most of my work is in research, but we'll kind of go backwards. So we'll start with hallucinogens. This is kind of a very broad class of drugs. There's sedatives, there's, different types of drug classes that we think of as sort of the major types that are out there. And hallucinogens is just one broad one that includes a lot of different types of drugs, a lot of different types of mechanisms of action. Many of them are naturally occurring. Many of them are man-made and synthetic chemicals. And so there happen to be a number of subclasses of hallucinogens within that, which include what we call the classic psychedelics. And so psychedelics is, that word psychedelic was first coined back in the 1950s by a British psychiatrist named Humphrey Osmond. And that at the time, they were trying to figure out how to talk about these substances, mainly LSD, but also mescaline. They actually were not yet familiar with psilocybin in Western science, as a matter of fact. But they came up with that word, and Osmond specifically came up with that word as a way to try to characterize the effects that he had observed through both self-experimentation, but also through working with patient populations in Saskatchewan, where he was working at the time, and many of whom were having what seemed to be very revelatory experiences under the influence, particularly of LSD. And so, he came up with this word psychedelic because to him that denoted that these drugs were sort of revealing this content that was already manifest in the mind. Sort of kind of uncovering what was in the psyche in a way. And that's congruent with a lot of other later researchers like Stan Grof, for instance, who talked about psychedelics as non-specific amplifiers of, the contents of consciousness. And, the term psychedelic now has really bled out into the popular culture in a way where, people talk about psychedelic art and psychedelic music and even fashion and stuff like that. And so obviously that's not specifying these specific types of drugs, but when the word was coined originally, it was meant to denote these particular types of substances, and their primary mechanism of action, as far as we can tell at this point, is through serotonin 2A receptor agonism. And so there's a few naturally occurring substances that do that. So mescaline is one, which is found in a number of different cacti like San Pedro and peyote. There's also psilocybin, which is found in about 200 different species of fungi, primarily in the psilocybe genus. There's also dimethyltryptamine or DMT, which is found in many different plants and animals, and which is made used to make ayahuasca, which is an indigenous brew that is used in cultures primarily in South America and Central America as well. And LSD was a semi-synthetic psychedelic that was first made in a laboratory, and that is another one of these classic psychedelics, but, it gained the most notoriety, really, first through experimentation and scientific research in the middle of 20th century, but then obviously as part of the counterculture in the 1960s. So in terms of the actual, you know, mushrooms that we're talking about, I mean, again, there's lots of different types of mushrooms, but the type that produce psilocybin, which is an alkaloid, basically, you know, there's just a number of these that are creating this alkaloid. Just like, you know, a coffee bean creates caffeine, which is a naturally occurring alkaloid that binds to our adenosine receptors in the brain. Psilocybin containing mushrooms create this psilocybin, which binds to our serotonin receptors and pretty much, you know, most of our serotonin receptors in the human brain and the animal brain. And so when people are talking about quote unquote microdosing, what they're, you know, referring to often is taking very small, what might be considered sub-perceptual doses of these psychedelic drugs or other types of hallucinogens. And that can, you know, often include psilocybin mushrooms, but also LSD. And, you know, I've heard about people microdosing just about anything at this point because it's become this sort of popular culture thing, you know, this sort of fad, really. But it's not a well-specified practice. And the idea is that by perhaps taking a very small amount of this every few days, you know, a drug like psilocybin or LSD, that it may produce some sort of like mental health or well-being benefits, which would be very consistent with what you would be doing if you're giving a patient, for instance, like an SSRI or another type of serotonergic pharmacological agent. And so that's really the idea of that, behind that type of practice. There's really limited rigorous information right now in terms of microdosing. So it's very difficult to study because of the controlled status of these substances. You know, if we were to have a study of microdosing, I'd have to ask you to come to the lab like every 3 days and sit here for 6 hours while we, you know, gave you a very small dose of the drug that, or a placebo. And so obviously that becomes very ungainly quite quickly. It's hard to get some of these regulatory agencies to allow us to let people take these drugs home because they're heavily controlled substances. So it's hard to say what microdosing really does. Most of the evidence I've seen convinces me that it's primarily a placebo effect. There may be some very mild biological signature that could be useful. But to me, it really takes a lot of the important features out of the drug and the types of drug therapies that we're studying here, because typically we just use one or a few doses and those tend to have very profound impacts that last a very long time, as opposed to this microdosing type of model.
I would love to talk more about that aspect of the dosing as we move through this. That was a really helpful overview, I think, of the classic psychedelics also and how they're working in the brain. Just to go back to definitions for a minute, what would you consider the non-classic psychedelics? So specifically, how do ketamine, ecstasy, some of those other compounds that we encounter clinically, how do they fit in?
Yeah, and this is a matter of expert opinion, if you will, because other people have and will argue about this type of terminology and, you know, say, oh, you know, that they're purists, that they think classic psychedelics are only these serotonin 2A agonists and such. But again, Osman was talking about those types of drugs when he came up with the word. So I think it's historically accurate, if nothing else. You know, there's other types of delirients, scopolamine. You know, there's other types of drugs, anticholinergic drugs like Datura. There's other types of hallucinogenic drugs, as you said, non-classic psychedelics, if you want to call them that, including ketamine, dissociatives, you know, is typically what you would call that, a dissociative anesthetic. Nitrous oxide can be another one depending on the dose. And yeah, you mentioned MDMA. So that's another, what we would call, you know, an entactogen is usually the terminology, or an empathogen. These are words that have been coined again to try to capture some of the flavor of the quality of the drug experience that people have when they take these substances. And so those in particular are some of the key ones. There's others like salvia divinorum, which is really interesting, but just because of the uniqueness of the pharmacology and mechanism of action, I would, you know, hesitate to call it anything particular, you know, in that list of terms that we gave you. And ibogaine as well, you know, is another one of these that's really, really fascinating. But in terms of polypharmacology, it's extremely complex, and it also has potential toxicity, which is one of the reasons why it's not studied as widely.
Yeah, thank you for that overview. I think, and I love the kind of the historical basis that really kind of described why they're called it. That kind of, I know for me, it kind of helped me remember which ones are the psychedelics and how they work on the serotonin receptor. You talked a little bit about, again, that microdosing are these kind of low, kind of subtherapeutic, or maybe homeopathic, kind of by your description, dosing doesn't really have the effect, but there are bigger doses that have the beneficial effect. And what do you find is the beneficial effect? Like, what's the positive thing that comes from that?
Well, so far, in terms of clinical trials that we've seen published in the last couple of decades, not to mention a very, you know, earlier era of research that was done back between 1950 and 1970, roughly. But really, more recently, what you've seen is pretty rigorous data that specifically high-dose psilocybin has robust, rapid-acting antidepressant effects. Probably that these class of psychedelics are also rapid-acting anxiolytics that have ongoing efficacy. So not just when you're on the drug, but for weeks afterwards. And so we've seen that now in a number of trials that have been replicated in Switzerland and the U.S., you know, in different parts of the world, you know, by different laboratories in London. And so when you're looking at those data, the findings are pretty compelling in my eyes that there is a strong antidepressant effect of these drugs, even after one high dose. And now one thing I should back up and say, though, is that when we're dealing particularly with psychiatric diagnoses, we're using these as adjuncts to therapy. So we're not just giving the person the drug, telling them to go home and take it and then, you know, give me a call tomorrow or something. It's something that's happening in the course of a therapeutic process. Now, you know, what exactly are the particulars of that therapy or that process? You know, I think still remains to be seen because it hasn't been well studied. But we have a general idea for how to do it safely and effectively. And so those are the parameters that we tend to use, which are heavily based on the work that came out of the earlier era of research from the 1960s primarily. But yeah, so those are some of the main ones that we've seen is that people with major depression, treatment-resistant major depression, people with cancer-related existential distress particularly, that's been another big area is in palliative medicine, are getting these long-lasting benefits in terms of improvements in mood, reductions in anxiety, you know, enhanced well-being, and something like that, which can last often months or even years after going through some of these experiences. Now, that's not true for everyone that has, you know, these experiences or goes through this type of treatment, but we've seen by and large a fairly good proportion of those folks that are going through are getting these benefits and, you know, reporting those back to us. In addition to antidepressant and anxiolytic types of effects that we've seen, another area that's really big interest of mine is using these in treatment of substance use disorders. And that actually was one of the big areas of early research, as a matter of fact. So Osmond and others were using LSD and other psychedelics to try to help people, mainly with alcohol use disorder. But also there was a great study that was published here in Baltimore. It was done here in Baltimore and published back in 1973 with men with opioid dependence and also finding what I think are really promising results. And so, you know, we're finally reopening the books in that area, looking at psychedelics and addiction treatment. And I think that there is probably a ton of potential there that is untapped and that I hope we'll be able to get out to people, you know, through more research in the coming years. But we've certainly seen good findings to date in treating alcohol use disorder. My lab and myself and Matt Johnson, who is one of my mentors here in Baltimore, you know, have done a lot of work with cigarette smokers and showing great potential there as well. We'll be publishing a big paper later this year that I think will certainly raise some eyebrows because of what we found in terms of using a single dose of psilocybin in comparison to an FDA-approved treatment and, you know, how effective that seemed to be.
That might be a good segue to come back to our case here, because I think the next question is going to build on that. So let's say your patient at this point says that he's nervous to try mushrooms because of his history with alcohol. He asks if he has a risk of developing a psilocybin use disorder if he tries it and what other risks he should consider. So first of all, psychedelic use disorder, is there anything documented about that? I mean, if so, what does it look like? If not, why might that be the case?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly hallucinogen use disorder. It's in the DSM, and it's something that's, you know, been known to happen. Now, in terms of developing the same type of physiological dependence that you develop on other substances of abuse on psychedelics, that's not something that happens because of the, you know, there's some unique aspects of the pharmacology of these drugs that make it so that they're not addictive the same way that, for instance, cocaine, tobacco, alcohol, you know, you name it, opioids are. And, you know, a lot of those drugs are thought to produce this reinforcing effect because of both the positive effects, but also the withdrawal that comes along when people are having the effects wear off and then seeking that again and getting trapped in the cycle. And so with the classic psychedelics, there is no real withdrawal syndrome. And that's in part because of what they call tachyphylaxis, which is that the brain is, you know, rapidly responding to exposure to the drug, so that if you're taking the same dose of LSD multiple days in a row, you will quickly lose the ability to perceive or feel any effects at all. So it's not working anymore, basically, or at least not in a way that you're going to notice. And so people will typically stop. Not to mention, you know, the effects themselves are quite long lasting. So it's not something that lends itself to casual use on a regular basis. That being said, some people do develop a psychological dependence on these types of substances. But you more often are going to see that in the course of a sort of a polypharmacy where people are using lots of drugs. They're using alcohol, they're using tobacco, they're using MDMA, they're using psychedelics, and maybe they're using cocaine and amphetamines. So, you know, in those cases, sure, this might be part of a bigger syndrome. But again, typically I would think of that as kind of a symptom that has some underlying problems that need to be addressed so that people can, you know, get away from that, you know, substance use or misuse, if you will.
And are there other risks that we should be considering or counseling people about, or even contraindications that?
There's a ton of other risks. And I mean, I think the main one you gotta say is these are illegal drugs. So if you're caught, you know, possessing them, if you're caught selling them or buying them, you could go to jail, you could lose custody of your children, you could lose your job. So all of those things can happen. The possibility is very real that if you're buying these substances and you're using them, you can get into some sort of legal trouble. You know, some of the other things that are risks that need to be considered over and above that are that there are people who may have really adverse reactions to these drugs. And it's hard to tell who those folks are going to be unless you do a pretty intensive medical mental health history with them. But generally speaking, anyone who's got a personal or family history of psychosis or bipolar mood runs the risk of developing those types of problems after exposure to these substances. And so now we've seen a number of case reports in the last few years where people are trying these DIY, I'm going to go treat myself and I'm going to get some drugs, whatever I find from this guy on the street or a friend of a friend or wherever it is that they're getting these things. And then, you know, developing really serious and protracted mental health problems that could last perhaps the rest of their lives. And so that's a huge risk that needs to be, you know, considered and seriously. And there's other related risks. The main ones are cardiovascular in nature. A couple of things, you know, primarily these drugs raise blood pressure, heart rate. So people who have, you know, pre-existing cardiovascular conditions like uncontrolled hypertension, you know, prolonged QTC interval, other types of things that a person may have and not know, or, you know, may not know too much about, you know, could respond poorly to exposure to these drugs. And particularly with microdosing, there's a good case to be made that because these drugs affect the serotonin 2B receptor as well as the serotonin 2A receptor and a number of others, that they could create valvular heart disease, specifically through chronic administration. So that's not something that we would worry so much about in one of our treatment models where we're using like one or two doses over the course of a few months. But if this is something that you're taking like once every few days for several months, it's quite possible that this could be damaging the heart in ways that could create serious problems for people. And it's the reason why drugs like Fen-Phen, for instance, were taken off the market, because they were causing those types of problems through serotonin 2B receptor activity.
Yeah. Thank you for kind of both emphasizing, talking through the medical issues, both the cardiac and kind of some of the psychiatric issues of maybe kind of exposing bipolar disorder, having it come on in someone with a history, but also really centering the fact that, like so many of the substances we see, like some of the biggest issues are related to the illegality of it and kind of the disproportionate violence and all those things that come with that. It seems like one of the bigger risks with this. Can you talk a little bit about the legality of hallucinogens, and is that something that is changing or kind of pretty stagnant right now?
I mean, it depends on what level you're looking at, because, and you know, this is a complex kind of quagmire in terms of what the actual policy is in the U.S. And so there's 50 states in the United States, and then there's, you know, the federal government, which has its own set of rules and regulations. But I will just say that regardless of where you are in the U.S., these drugs are illegal just by federal mandate, because they're considered Schedule I substances. So even if you're in a place like D.C., Oakland, you know, there's other parts of the country like Colorado, Oregon, where there have been initiatives to either decriminalize or provide some sort of access to these substances, you know, through certain mechanisms. Nevertheless, you know, they remain illegal at the federal level, unless, you know, you have a Schedule I license and investigation and your drug application through the FDA, basically all the stuff that our lab has. Or do you have some sort of expanded access approval to use this because you have a serious illness? And those are very few and far between. So this is a part of the problem, though. And, you know, I was talking to a reporter earlier this week, because a bunch of people are hospitalized all over the country. I think it was in like 16 different states. You have 26 people showing up at emergency rooms who have been buying, quote unquote, microdosing chocolates, you know, either at dispensaries or on the internet. It doesn't say what's in them. And nevertheless, what was in them was poisonous, and it caused all these people to have to go, you know, to the emergency room having seizures, and also, you know, some people going unconscious. And, you know, that's part of the problem, is that I think with all the popular media hype and then all the confusion around what the actual laws are, it's, you know, fairly simple to get confused about that and just think, well, I saw this in a store. I mean, it must be fine for me to buy it and use it. Well, not necessarily. And also, that's the other big problem when you're buying these substances, especially on the black market. They're not regulated in any way. So people can literally put anything they want in them. And maybe it has psilocybin, maybe it doesn't. You know, a lot of these edibles have been tested recently. And what they found was that up to a third of those products in this specific batch that they bought, you know, to test, did not contain any psilocybin. They contain 4-ACO-DMT, which is a man-made synthetic chemical that has not been well tested in terms of its toxicology profile, and who knows what else is in there. So, you know, buyer beware in terms of buying these types of things, you know, either on black market or in dispensaries or online, because it might say one thing on the label and it may have something very different in the product itself. So the safety is indeterminate at best, I would say. And then that's the other thing, is the dose, you know, so you really have to imagine like going to a bar, for instance, and saying, let me get a Budweiser, where you would basically be getting 12 or 16 ounces of 5%, you know, BAC content. And, you know, more or less, I can drink two of these and then I can walk home and I'll be okay. Whereas what you're getting, you don't know if that's going to be two glasses of 100 proof Everclear. You don't know if that's going to be something completely different, like formaldehyde. You really just have no idea what you're getting. And so obviously that can be very dangerous. And unfortunately, there's, you know, unscrupulous and bad actors out there who are selling and manufacturing things that can be harmful. And so that's what we're seeing, you know, now, is, and I'm sure we'll see more of that, unfortunately, in the future.
I'm also curious where this resurgence of interest is coming from. I mean, you mentioned the popularity recently. Do you think that use also has actually increased, or is it just the media? Do we have data on that?
Yeah, we know that use has increased by looking at trends in like things like the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, and you know, big national representative data sets do show that there have been increases in hallucinogen use over the last decade, roughly. And, you know, my best guess is, and I wrote a blog about this for Psychology Today, which I recommend, you know, it's short, but it kind of tries to succinctly point this out, which is, you know, that this is a generational thing. There's a sort of swing of the pendulum, if you will, in terms of the way that maybe our parents or our parents' parents' generations viewed psychoactive substances and what was okay and what was not okay. And those views have been evolving over time. One of many things that have changed over the last few decades, and you all as doctors, I'm sure, are quite familiar, is the preponderance of psychiatric medicines. And so nowadays, you know, there's quite a lot of people who are on antidepressant medicines, anxiolytic medicines, you know, other types of medications of that ilk. And so having grown up and seeing a lot of people on these or maybe taking them oneself, and perhaps having a positive or not so positive experience, I think can really color some of the way that we think about, you know, these medicines, not to mention against the backdrop of the opioid crisis, where we see drugs like opioids that have been very, very potent and that have become huge problems, even though these are approved medicines. And so it really, I think, calls into question for some people, should they be using those? And perhaps are there other avenues for them to get, you know, some sort of relief for their medical or mental health symptoms, which I think has also led a lot of people to seek out other types of remedies, whether that be something like cannabis, which has become obviously much more widespread, you know, over the last few decades. But then also perhaps these psychedelics as well represent, you know, another way that people are thinking about, you know, wellness and well-being nowadays that perhaps, you know, was not so popular in the last few decades.
Yeah, I think I both interesting both kind of the framing, and we talk about in kind of a lot of addiction medicine too, about the unregulatedness of this is where a lot of the danger comes from, and also why kind of there's been a resurgence both in the news, but people may be getting more used to finding ways to address kind of underlying stress, mental health issues, and things like that over the course of different generations. But to kind of go back to our gentleman, our case again. So Mr. Hoffman tells us he's tried LSD a few times in his 20s, generally thought he had a positive experience. He says a few years ago, he went around to parties and everybody was smoking cannabis, but now people are just like you kind of said, are starting to bring mushroom chocolates and nobody really knows what's in them. But with somebody who's being exposed to this and is kind of interested in trying, what is this unregulated supply? Do you have a sense of how to counsel people on the risks of this? Like, how do you stay safe if you're choosing to use an unregulated supply?
You know, that's a tough nut to crack. I think in terms of the law and liability, it's pretty clear that you're going to have to tell people that you can't counsel them to use these substances because they're against the law and unregulated. And so whatever they're getting, they're not going to know what they're getting. But at the same time, from a harm reduction standpoint, you know, the data that we have on the substances themselves are actually, they seem pretty benign. You know, they're not toxic. You can take a very high dose of psilocybin and it's not going to cause any sort of damage to make your organ systems. So, you know, you take a bottle of benzodiazepines or opioids or, you know, drink a bottle of vodka or even, you know, a bottle of Tylenol and, you know, it can cause some serious damage. Now, you take a big bag of mushrooms and you may have a very psychologically harrowing experience, but physiologically, your body is likely going to be pretty safe. You know, the only exceptions being, as we had mentioned, you know, the people who may have cardiovascular problems or perhaps predisposition to other mental health issues. So it's tough to walk that line, though, I think, for clinicians. And I know that it's becoming much more commonplace for therapists and doctors and, you know, folks in the medical field in general to be getting these questions. And I honestly not sure how to respond other than to try to provide, you know, real evidence-based information to say, like, this is what we know about these substances. And part of the problem being, as you said, if you're getting something out there, then you may not know what it is exactly that you are getting. Can be difficult to test. It can, you know, be difficult to quantify. So, you know, that those are challenges, obviously.
I mean, we talked a little bit about microdosing before, but you also just mentioned a high dose experience and how that's different. What can we tell patients about that? I mean, what is happening when somebody really takes a high dose of any of these? Either what they can expect or, in the brain, how is that different than if somebody's just microdosing, which, as we discussed, might be something that's a little more homeopathic?
So again, very complex in terms of the brain mechanisms. We don't really know, to be frank. We can, you know, go across multiple different levels of systems to talk about the different types of effects that we've observed, whether we're talking about changes in epigenetics, changes in neuroplasticity at the circuit level in places like the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus. You know, we're seeing brainwide connectivity changes in terms of how the networks in the brain are communicating and synchronizing or not when people are under the influence. And so all of these things are things that we've measured, you know, roughly over the last decade or two to try to characterize the biological mechanisms. I would say that we're still pretty far from understanding how they work, but I would also say we're pretty far from understanding how the brain works, how addiction works in the brain, how most of the medicines we use work in the brain. You know, a lot of this is very hand wavy. And it is because, you know, it's an incredibly complicated system to begin with. But yeah, I mean, what we've seen so far is that these drugs exert a particular profile of effects that, at least from a psychological standpoint, seem to be acutely, it's hard to really characterize. And that's one of the words that we use actually to describe many of these experiences is ineffable, meaning that, you know, putting them into words is quite difficult. And I think of like this Chinese poet, Chuang Tzu, says, you know, when you have the butterfly and then you take it and you pin it to the board, you know, to put it on your collection, you still got you have the butterfly, but you've lost the flight. And so when you are trying to talk about these experiences, I think it's like that. And, you know, this is something that's often expressed. If you want to put it in very kind of bland medical terminology, we have perceptual alterations. We have changes in the sense of self. We have different cognitive and emotional types of changes and alterations that are happening. Now, saying that, though, again, is kind of like showing you a picture of a chocolate cake, but when you eat it, you know, it tastes, you know, a way that you're really going to have a hard time gleaning from just looking at the picture. And so I think that's part of the problem here. Nevertheless, you know, we do talk about this a lot because we have to do an informed consent for our research process. And so we go through this, and really what we tend to go through is like, what are the main risks? Many of which include, and you know, I don't think we talked about this, and it wasn't really relevant in the microdosing case, but you know, one of the big risks is that people can have really acute, challenging psychological experiences where they're having strong anxiety, paranoia, fear. They may have delusional types of thinking. So that type of thing can develop under the influence of high doses of these psychedelics. But then people can also have what we talk about as an ego dissolution type experience where their sense of self sort of falls away or disintegrates in a way. And, you know, what's left when you get beyond that is something of a mystery, but you know, it's more in the realm of philosophy, I suppose, than medicine. You know, we try to understand these experiences and, you know, again, we measure them in the brain and we talk to people about them. But the quality of the experience itself, at least in my experience working with people in these states, is that it seems to really help them to see themselves, see their place in the world, think about their relationships, and often, you know, think about their issues, whether that be depression, anxiety, substance use, in a different way. And so, you know, the best way I've really been able to think about that is kind of the way that when a person undergoes a really severe trauma, you know, that can really impact them in a way that is detrimental, and that can be ongoing for years afterwards. And I think when people have some of these experiences with high-dose psychedelics, it can sort of work in reverse, where it allows them to really think and see things quite differently in a way that persists, you know, and often that's in a beneficial way. And, you know, in particular, when you're doing this with a skilled therapeutic team or with the appropriate container, I think that you can really kind of hone into whatever it was that was meaningful and useful for an individual from these experiences to try to help them to get the most mileage out of them. And so that's, I guess, how best I can explain it in a very short period of time.
So we are going to jump into the last part of our case now. So your patient says that although he wants to be cautious because of his history with alcohol, he's also heard that psychedelic-assisted therapy can help people cut down on alcohol. What is psychedelic-assisted therapy?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that really delineates in an important way that, you know, recreational use of these substances is one thing. Using these in a therapeutic framework is very different. And I would also just point out that for a long time, you know, since before Western medicine was even aware that these substances existed, indigenous cultures have been using these substances as part of their kind of religious and spiritual lives. And so this is something that we have records going back hundreds, if not thousands of years, showing that, you know, people have been using these substances for a long time. But, you know, just like using fire, you know, there's a lot of ways you can use it, whether you're using it to cook a meal or, you know, burning a house down. What your intent is and the way that you're doing that is very important. And so when you're talking about psychedelic assisted therapy, we're talking about putting the sort of trappings of Western medicine or psychotherapy around the psychedelic as part of a treatment, specifically to treat a condition such as major depression, or in this case, alcohol use disorder. So when you're doing the psychedelic assisted therapy, you know, this is a long and protracted process. It's not just something that happens over the course of a day or two. Usually, at least in the clinical trials that we do, the way that this is done is there's, you know, an intensive screening beforehand. We would take an EKG. We would do a blood panel. You know, we do a full medical history and physical, as well as a mental health history, and, you know, going deep to make sure that this person is safe to receive the drug. Now, that's something that doesn't always happen, obviously, on a recreational level, hence some of the risks that we discussed earlier. But when we do that, then we're able to screen out people for whom we think it's most likely not safe that they get these. And so, unfortunately, you know, we kind of have to set them aside and refer them to other types of treatments. But for the people that, you know, are able to enroll in these clinical trials, once you get past the screening process, we're usually doing something like 3 to 4 weeks of some kind of counseling or structured therapy. That's something that happens before there's any drug administered. And there's a few reasons for this. One of them is just so that the people who are going to be sitting with the patient or with the participant throughout their drug experience has a good sense for who this person is, what their life experience has been like, what are the issues that they're trying to deal with, you know, forming some coherent treatment goals. You know, all of that stuff is really part and parcel to the preparatory process, where you're really sitting with this individual, and usually a team of a couple of facilitators that will be going through the whole, you know, the whole process with you, not just the prep, but the prep, the dosing, and then the aftercare. And so, you know, during that first month or so, you know, people will come in, they'll often talk about, you know, their history of alcohol use, for instance, maybe some salient life events in terms of, you know, their formative years, important relationships, their career, and, you know, talk more about what it is that they're hoping to move towards in terms of their ideal future in the treatment. So once that happens, you know, we also provide a bit of psychoeducation, which is more geared towards, you know, what type of experiences people might have when they're under the influence, how they might respond to the drug, and should they have a particularly difficult experience, you know, how to navigate that, and how we're going to work with them to do that. Because it's not kind of like, well, you're on your own, good luck. You know, part of the reason that we're forming this working relationship is because I'm going to be there with you. And so you need to trust me, and I need to, you know, understand what you're going through. And that way, when, you know, things get difficult, then you feel comfortable to go through the protocol with me and say, okay, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling paranoid, I don't know what's going on right now. And when they can turn to you and look at you and say that, you know, rather than kind of keeping it internalized, then that allows for a sort of diffusion of the process where you can work with them to walk through it. And so, you know, we've done over 900 psilocybin dosing sessions here since 2000 at the lab. And in every one of those sessions, we have a little box full of what we call rescue medicines, which include, you know, anxiolytic drugs and also antipsychotic drugs, which if needed can help people to deal with any sort of agitation or dysphoria. Now, you know, in the, over the course of those 900 dosing sessions, I can think of perhaps three instances where we use one of those medicines. And the reason is because we spent all that time preparing for the experience. So people usually feel like they know what they're getting into. And also they feel like they have a good sense of rapport and working relationship with the facilitators, which I think is really important to be able to do the work safely. So once you get through that, though, then you go into the dosing sessions. And, you know, the different types of models that have been developed will usually use between one and three dosing sessions. They're typically spaced out by at least a week, sometimes a couple of weeks or even longer. And we would usually start with maybe a somewhat lower dose. Now we'll start with a high dose regardless, usually in the realm of about 20 to 25 milligrams. But particularly for people with substance use disorders, it's been noted, you know, even since the early literature in the 1960s, that they seem to be less responsive to these drugs for whatever reason. And so in some of these cases, you have to push the dose up. Because the drugs are not physiologically toxic, it's pretty safe to do that, but it's safer, you know, to start with a lower dose. So in that 20 to 25 milligram range is normally what we would do. And that's how my colleague, actually, Michael Bogenschutz, who's over at Langone, where you are, conducted some of his studies, which includes the largest randomized controlled trial of psilocybin-assisted therapy for alcohol use disorder. They started with a 25 milligram dose. And depending on how people respond to that, then they either stick to that 25 milligrams for a second dosing session a few weeks later, or they'll move up to a higher dose. I think in that case, it was 40 milligrams. When those dosing sessions are happening, we're not very hands-on. We're usually kind of sitting back. We're watching people go through the experience. If they have, you know, something difficult come up, we're there to help support them. And that's usually in the form of just hand-holding or interpersonal reassurance. Like, it's this is going to be okay. This will pass. You know, making sure that people mainly are safe, that they don't do anything dangerous or risky, you know, while they're under the influence. Those sessions usually last about 8 hours. So people will come in around 8 or 9 in the morning and they'll be, you know, out the door by 5 or 6. And just like when you get, you know, a surgical procedure where you're under anesthesia, you know, somebody else is going to have to come pick you up and make sure that you get home safely, because we don't let people just walk out on their own recognizance. So that's another big part of the process. You know, after the screening and the prep, we will do one or several of these high dose sessions. During the sessions, again, you know, people are laying down most of the time. They're often listening to music. And if they need to talk to us, we engage. But we almost, you know, exclusively ask them to focus on their inner experience. What's going on inside your mind? Just pay attention to that. You don't have to tell us right away. Yes, you know, that should be the main focus for now. And afterwards, you know, we'll kind of debrief and come back and talk more about that. And that's really what the aftercare process is all about. It's what we call this integration process. And so this is really about kind of diving into the contents of the experience, what people make out of that experience, and what kind of meaning or valuable insights they may have gained or not from the experience. And so that's something that happens. Usually we'll check in with the person, you know, at least the day after they have their sessions. But then typically we'll continue to talk to them for several weeks, you know, up to maybe anywhere from, you know, 6 to 8 weeks afterwards. We'll be in regular contact for weekly visits, checking in, talking about their experience, and also continuing to provide that therapeutic support. So if you told me, for instance, well, right now I'm drinking 10 beers a day, and I would really like my, you know, next level of intake to be closer to 2 or 3 beers a day, and then, you know, you'll remind people of that, and you kind of come back to that and ask them, you know, where are you with your alcohol use, and, you know, how are your cravings, and how is, you know, that impacting your life, and how has your experience informed all of this? So really, that's the way that I see these types of therapeutic models. At least right now, you know, because there's still a lot to learn in terms of best practices and what types of therapies work the best for certain conditions or for certain individuals. Because we've used, for instance, cognitive behavioral therapy combined with psilocybin for cigarette smokers, and that seems to work pretty well. You know, Michael at NYU has use motivational enhancement therapy with folks with alcohol use dependence. And that also seems to work pretty well when paired with psilocybin, better than the talk therapy alone. And, you know, others have suggested using ACT, using other types of therapeutic interventions, mindfulness training. You know, so there's a lot of different therapies and kind of modalities that we can throw at this that have yet to be systematically tested. But at this point, you know, this is sort of where we're at in the early stage of the science here, because this has been very slow going, unfortunately. It's been taking, you know, it's taken quite a long time to get here even. So.
Yeah. I really appreciate you kind of painting the picture of what, because I haven't heard, I mean, I've read some of the studies, but it doesn't like really paint the picture of like what the actual experience is like for the person and how different it is from the kind of DIY, like you said, kind of finding a hallucinogen and trying to maybe self-treat versus like what this really formalized moving towards, or at this point, evidence-based model for kind of hallucinogen-assisted or psychedelic-assisted therapy. I know none of them are FDA approved or are at this point, but is there one that's moving closer that you cut? And again, kind of guessing your opinion, you expect to be coming down the pipeline sooner than the others, or for which indications and that kind of thing?
Yeah. So what it seems like right now is that MDMA is pretty close to getting an FDA approval because they've completed 2 phase 3 clinical trials, which are usually, you know, the last hurdle that needs to be cleared to show that the drug is safe and effective. And those have been specifically MDMA-assisted therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, there has been some pushback lately. There's been some back and forth with FDA and some other parties who, you know, have raised some concerns. So it's unclear what the course is going to be in terms of whether that's going to be approved sooner rather than later. But the data that I've seen are very compelling, and I'm convinced that it's an effective treatment that should likely be approved and available for people who are struggling with PTSD, because it's an incredibly debilitating and difficult to treat condition. We don't have a lot of effective therapies there. You know, other than that, there's a few others that, you know, are kind of in the pipeline. Psilocybin being a big one. That one, you know, as I mentioned, is being studied for addictions and, you know, substance use disorders, but is primarily being looked at right now as an antidepressant. And so a couple of different entities are trying to develop psilocybin-assisted treatment for major depression. And so I think within a few years, there's a good possibility that psilocybin will be a new approved medical treatment for depression and treatment-resistant depression. And so that's something that's not come to pass quite yet. But in order to do these studies, I was just sitting down with one of the researchers from UK recently, and they're doing a big study with sites all over the world that are trying to get 800 people into this study. And so there's going to be sites popping up all over. We're working on a similar phase 3 trial here at Hopkins. And again, we'll just be one of many sites that will be recruiting patients. And so although they're not approved treatments, I do think it's important for people to know that there's a good possibility they may be able to get access to these through one of these clinical trials, and that all of the clinical trials that are happening are always going to be registered at a website that's a U.S. government website, clinicaltrials.gov. And so if people go to that site, clinicaltrials.gov, they can put in what condition they're dealing with. They can put in what types of treatments they're interested in. You know, they can put in what state they're in and look for what's happening near them. And so even if it's not an approved medicine, it's something that I think the access is kind of slowly but surely widening. And, you know, even outside the U.S., you see that in places like Canada and Australia, where, you know, there's being provisions made for patients to be able to access these treatments. Other drugs like, you know, LSD-like molecules and other psychedelics are being looked at, too, for generalized anxiety disorder. And so I think this is just the beginning. You know, you're going to see a wave of more of these types of medicines that are going to be studied and seeking approval over the next decade. And so the likelihood is, you know, there'll be a few of these out there, you know, in 10 years, maybe, that people will be able to talk to their doctors and go out and get. But for now, yeah, it is sort of limited in terms of access, which I think is, you know, really challenging for people who are struggling with, you know, recalcitrant mental health conditions right now. And, you know, there are other medicines, though, that are out there, like ketamine, which people can access if they can afford it. You know, an unfortunate factor there is that it's not insurance covered, although certain types of ketamine treatment are, especially esketamine is something that if people have failed several antidepressant medicines to respond to in the past, that they may be able to get access to esketamine. You know, and there's other, obviously, other modalities, whether we're talking about talk therapy or TMS, you know, brain stimulation types of therapies that are out there in clinics that people can get access to, and that I would encourage them to seek out if, you know, they're really struggling with their mental health.
Ketamine seems like such an interesting one because I know at least around us in New York, there are just so many clinics that have popped up with varying degrees of medical oversight, it seems. And I just don't even know where to start to tell people what to do.
Yeah, it's difficult because the way that ketamine is administered varies widely. You know, you could get an intranasal formulation like esketamine in a doctor's office, or you might get intramuscular or intravenous infusions. You might get an oral lozenge in a psychotherapist's office. Some of this might be sent home for you to take at home even. And so, yeah, I think it is very dizzying to see all these different variety of options out there. But finding at least somebody that may have gone to one of these clinics or talking to you know, the providers may be a good first step is what I usually advise, because kind of like going to a mechanic. I mean, you have somebody that you trust because a friend told you, you know, that they did good work, or, you know, you've had a good experience with them, or you go talk to them and you feel like you trust them or not. But otherwise, it's really hard to tell, you know, what are you getting? And so that's part of the problem. A lot of these treatments, you know, models do kind of a medication only, if you will. That's the kind of therapy that they offer. And so that's something that I would look askance at a little bit, because at least with the other classic psychedelics that we study, it seems to really help to have all this therapeutic support wrapped around the experience of the drug. And so, you know, if there are providers, which I know there are, that are providing some form of preparatory, you know, counseling and psychotherapy before, during, and after, you know, that's really the way that seems to work, at least again, in the studies that I've seen. And in some of those, you know, they've been done by colleagues like Elias Stockwar and Celia Morgan. You know, they've done some really cool work where you can see that when combined with the psychotherapy, just one or a few doses of ketamine can actually have these really profound and lasting benefits for people with substance use disorders in particular, but also potentially, you know, lots of other conditions like depression. So,
well, that's great. Thank you so much for all of this.
Yeah, I mean, this was genuinely one of the most interesting discussions I've had gotten to participate in. So thank you for kind of talking us through all this. Do you kind of, because I think this was such an expansive topic, do you have any like big points that you want our listeners who are often, I think, primary care physicians and the like to take away from this, or any kind of main points?
You know, I guess the field is still in a very early stage, but there is a lot of promise here. So I would say, you know, both be cautious and wary and skeptical, but also be open-minded. And particularly when we're talking about data and we're looking at not anecdotes, but we're talking about actual, you know, evidence from clinical trials or neuroimaging results and other types of research that's out there. The big problem, I think, has been with the media and, you know, the hype that's surrounding this, because it is infectious and, you know, it gets in the minds of patients, it gets in the minds of even potentially some providers in ways that may not be fully grounded in what we know. And so that's something to be really careful about. And, you know, there's people out there that are doing all sorts of things like microdosing coaching and providing services, or, you know, saying that they're shamans who may or may not be shamans, you know, and providing substances that you're not sure of. And so it's something that needs to be taken seriously, because there are cases where people are developing really serious problems, and including suicidality, including psychosis. So, you know, these are not necessarily just something that should be taken lightly either. I think those are the main ones, you know, but it's just a really fascinating topic that, you know, I'm hoping that we're going to get more information that is going to allow us to put this to use to help people, because At least having worked with people for 12 years now doing this, in clinical trial settings, it's been pretty clear to me that the majority of people who go through this in a vetted way are getting something valuable out of it. And so I think, we'd like to see that eventually get out into the world where practitioners can also, be able to see that.
Well, that's great. I think to close out, is there anything else that you would like to plug?
We're always doing different types of surveys and, these aren't necessarily clinical trials, but we're just finishing a survey study now of medical doctors and nurses and psychotherapists to ask about what they know and what they think about these types of treatments. So I would say definitely keep up with our lab and, what we're working on and what we're publishing. And if you feel compelled to do so, please respond to some of these because we find it to be very valuable to get, keep our fingers on the pulse of what's going on. And in particular with clinicians, all of that stuff is on our website, which is hopkinspsychedelic.org. And try to keep that, pretty active, but we're not going to spam you. We do have a newsletter that comes out 4 times a year. For people that are looking for clinical trials or for looking for information, we have some there and, there's definitely other sources that are reputable as well, but I'm just hoping that, again, people who are interested will be able to link up with the right information and be a little bit critical in terms of what they're consuming, because not everyone out there has necessarily got everybody's best interest in mind.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We are committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com.
Special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about that organization at ACAM, that's ACAM.org. And a special thanks to Kat, our writer and producer for this episode, and our reviewer, Kento Sonoda, and to our whole team. The Curbsiders is produced and edited by the team at Podpace. And until next time, I've been Sean Cohen.
And I am Kat Mullins. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you some addiction medicine pearls.